This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given. Early last month, Natalia Melman Petrozella, a history professor at the New School in New York City, was walking around her apartment.
Just kind of procrastinating by checking Twitter, and I just saw that all of a sudden my whole timeline was retweets with, you know, various kind of enthusiastic commentaries about, oh my God, I can't believe Nike's doing this.
This was the moment when Colin Kaepernick, the former Super Bowl starting quarterback, now better known for protesting racial inequality, was announced as the new face of Nike's Just Do It campaign.
Believe in something, even if it means sacrificing everything.
But while people in Natalia's timeline expressed surprise that Nike had aligned itself with such a controversial figure, Petrozella had a different reaction.
I am a historian. I think historically, I'm always like, you know, where did this come from? And so having spent a lot of time looking at Nike's ads, my first thought was like, okay, this is totally part of this tradition of moving the needle with kind of controversial branding that places sports and athletics in the context of something bigger.
Only a Game's Martin Kessler takes it from here.
Natalia Melman Petrozella says Nike's tradition of socially conscious branding goes back all the way to the 70s.
When they released their first women's running line, they named the shoes after kind of all these like quasi-feminist sayings. So, you know, there's like the Liberator. Today it all seems kind of cheesy, like big deal, women's empowerment branding. But back then, you just didn't have a lot of that.
Nike has run ads featuring Paralympians, runners who are overweight or in their 80s. And in 1994, the company reached out to a man named Rick Munoz. They wanted to put him in a commercial. Here's Rick.
I said to myself, if they go through with this, it's just going to be unlike anything that anyone has ever seen before. Just Do It didn't really go into this territory. And then, you know, using a person nobody knew. Who is this guy? He's a nobody, but he's got a story to tell.
Rick Munoz has always had good handwriting. That's not why Nike wanted to feature him in a commercial, but it's a good place to start his story. Rick grew up in LA without his dad, without any siblings, without any grandparents, without any aunts and uncles, just him and his mom.
And you would think that there would be this super-duper closeness between the two of us. And it was actually the opposite. She didn't express affection. She just worked all day, came home, cooked dinner, and we went our separate ways.
So when Rick's teachers started telling him he had nice penmanship, it mattered.
The only people who could give me positive feedback were the teachers.
Rick focused more and more on his handwriting. About a decade and a half later, the same sort of thing happened when he started running. Rick was late to the sport. He was already in his 20s, but more experienced runners were quick to compliment him on his times.
All the positive feedback from it really fed me and made me see what I was capable of.
Rick ran his first marathon in 1983, then another in 1984, and another in 1985, then three in 1986. The early 80s is also when Rick first learned about HIV and AIDS.
It was bad. Close friends, acquaintances, people that I had, you know, had personal, you know, physical relations with, it was getting them. There was a men's group that I belonged to. We showed up one weekend. We said, oh, where's, I can't remember his name, you know, Larry. And they said, oh, you know, Larry found out he had AIDS and he swallowed a bottle of Drano. And everybody went, what? You know, it was just so shocking. One friend of mine went into the hospital on a Friday because he was feeling poorly. By Monday, 3 days later, he was dead. You know, that is how quickly the whole thing happened. And so I just said, I just have to wait. I guess I'm just going to wait for my turn to come.
In 1987, at age 28, Rick decided to get tested. He wasn't surprised when he got the results. Positive. So when you got the diagnosis, mm-hmm. did you feel like it was a death sentence?
I didn't look at it as a death sentence so much as a challenge. It's like, who's going to win, me or the condition? I pretty much just said, I'm just going to do what makes me happy for as long as I can, as best I can. And when it comes time for me to go, then I'm going to go.
And for Rick, what made him happy was running.
I'd come to love the marathon distance, you know, and training for a 26-mile race is a lot. The race itself is a lot. And there was a woman in our running club, and she was a doctor, and she said, you know, Rick, I don't think maybe you should lay off the marathons because that's really taxing on the body. And I said, yeah, you could be right, but I love this too much to let it go or to let it affect me. And I just kept running.
And Rick kept getting faster. In 1989, he ran 8 marathons. In 1990, he ran 9 and qualified for the Boston Marathon for the first time. Now, before we get to what happened next in Rick's story, I want to pause for a second to talk about the stigma associated with HIV and AIDS back in the 90s. In 1994, Sean Stroob started a magazine called Pause, as in positive. It was about people affected by HIV and AIDS.
We would put people in the cover of the magazine. We'd make them look glamorous. We'd have, you know, fashion photographers and makeup artists, and we were criticized for that, you know, glamorizing AIDS.
Stroob says his sister, who was the magazine salesperson, faced challenges landing ads.
She finally got an appointment with a big major brand vitamin company. And, you know, we had all the data on people with HIV who were consuming an enormous amount of vitamins. They told her, we market our vitamins to well people, not to sick people.
When people with HIV and AIDS were being talked about in the mainstream, they were usually being completely pathologized. That was the climate when Rick Munoz got a call in 1994 from someone at Wieden & Kennedy, Nike's ad agency. They said they wanted to do an ad about a marathon runner with HIV.
And I said, you're kidding. And he says, no, no, we're serious. And I said, but you're kidding. He said, no, we're not. He goes, yeah, it's going to be a national commercial. And we were wondering if you'd be interested in doing it. And I said, does Nike know this? And then he said, yes, they're the ones who told us to do it. You know, and I said, oh, okay. If you think it's a good idea, count me in. There were people who said to me, you're really putting yourself out there. What about your job? What about future jobs? The whole world is going to know that you're HIV positive. You could get discriminated for your housing, for this and that. I said, I'm willing to take the risk.
3 weeks later, as he ran through Malibu Canyon State Park in front of a camera crew, Rick's biggest concern was whether he looked like a dork. After filming, Rick still worried that Nike would ultimately decide to pull the ad. But on February 9th, 1995, as he sat alone in his apartment watching that night's episode of ER, Rick saw himself appear on his TV screen.
It's got the music in the background, and it's got me running towards the camera and then running along the trail, and they flash my name on a title card. You know, Rick Munoz, Los Angeles, 10 marathons per year. And then at the very end, it says, HIV positive. Just do it. The impact was very immediate. You know, within the next 2 or 3 days, you know, stories in the New York Times praising it.
It sent a signal.
That's Pause Magazine founder Sean Stroob again.
First of all, a signal to people with HIV, which is, I think, the most important one, by showing someone with HIV who was out there and doing and accomplishing and sort of leading a life while managing this illness. But it also sent a broader signal about sort of recognizing the humanity and the survival and the full lives of people with HIV, not just defining us as a virus.
That kind of stuff matters. And I do think that, you know, Nike deserves some credit in that.
That's New School historian Natalia Melman Petrozella again.
This is the fundamental question that dogs Nike, as so much of its advertising has been so adventurous, is how does their corporate practice match up or not with that?
Petrozella points out that although Nike sold those Liberator shoes back in the 70s, there have been multiple allegations of sexual harassment and gender discrimination at the company. And there were the reports in the early 90s about the company's labor practices abroad. A 1992 Harper's article shared the story of an Indonesian factory worker making 14 cents an hour. Petrozella says two things can be true at once. Nike can be a profit-seeking corporation that's mistreated its employees here and abroad and still deserve credit for running advertisements starring women, the elderly, adaptive athletes, Rick Munoz, and now Colin Kaepernick.
I actually think representation matters. I think the takeaway from kind of the Nike story is that it's really up to us as critical consumers to decide the standards to which we want to hold companies to, because they're not going to do it for us. And actually, as becoming socially conscious becomes more and more marketable, it's probably going to be harder to discern which companies are actually living up to that and for which it is merely window dressing.
As for Rick Munoz, he's 60 years old now. He's been legally married for 10 years, and he's still running 40 to 50 miles a week.
That's Only a Game's Martin Kessler. We'll have a link to Natalia Melman Petrozella's recent Washington Post article about the tensions between Nike's values and reality at onlyagame.org. And for more on the life of Rick Munoz, check out the website Running and Ramblings article, Running for Life. While you might not be able to run a marathon or land a Nike deal, you can make a difference in our world by subscribing to Only a Game on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And while you're there, leave us a review. Anything you write will help other listeners find our show. Come on, just do it. When Rich Ellinson was a kid, his father told him stories about Johnny Unitas and the great Baltimore Colts of the 50s and 60s.
So then I would meet up with my friends who would talk about current players like Joe Montana or Troy Aikman or Brett Favre. And I'd say, well, yeah, you know, Unitas did that. And they would just roll their eyes because I was out to lunch, it seemed like, talking about a team that doesn't exist anymore.
That's coming up on Only a Game from NPR.
This message comes from Only a Game sponsor, Samuel Adams. Of all the beers Sam Adams has ever brewed, Boston Lager is their all-time favorite. With its distinctive balance of spicy hops, sweet roasted malts, and smooth finish, it stood the test of time and helped launch the whole craft beer revolution. Sam Adams Boston Lager. Full-flavored, rich, and complex. There's nothing quite like the taste of an original. Boston Beer Company, Boston, Mass. Savor responsibly.
Ever get to Friday, look back on the week, and say to yourself, what just happened? I'm Sam Sanders. Check out my podcast, It's Been a Minute, where every Friday we catch up on the news and the culture of the week and try to make sense of it all. Listen on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast.
I'm Karen Given. It's time for Three Stories You Should Know. We're down to just four teams vying for the World Series, and I know one of our guests this week is very excited about that. Sports Illustrated's Charlotte Wilder, welcome back.
Thank you, Karen. I'm thrilled to be here.
So, Jason Gay, Wall Street Journal, I guess that means you're playing the role of the person who is not excited about this baseball postseason.
I'm ambivalent about everything, Karen. You know that.
All right, Charlotte, take it away.
I am super excited about the Red Sox, which made being in the press box when they clinched really, really interesting. I got some bad looks. I like couldn't watch for the end of the ninth inning because I was so nervous, and then I freaked out when they won, and I was like, "This is wildly unprofessional."
Not allowed in the press box.
Yeah, no one liked that.
Did you uncork champagne on anyone in the locker room?
Yeah, it was like Cracker Jacks flying up in the air in the box. No, but I think, you know, I was super invested in the ALDS, as I think a lot of people were, because, you know, Yankees Red Sox, first time meeting in the postseason since 2004. When I was also really invested. But what was interesting to me about this series is that I went into it assuming that every fan would be jazzed for the rivalry. And yet, when I went to Fenway and Yankee Stadium also, I found that fans weren't as dedicated to hating the other team as I expected them to be.
Do you think that part of the issue, I mean, besides the fact that the dragon was slain in 2004, but Also, the Red Sox and the Yankees, these current teams are kind of likable. They don't have enough jerks, the Red Sox and Yankees. They need more jerks for that rivalry to be really a thing.
No, Jason, that's exactly what people said at Fenway. They were like, we don't have the same characters. You know, there's not a lot not to like about Aaron Judge.
Nice guy. Seems nice.
He was delightful.
Like to have him over for dinner.
You know, I go into the locker room and I get yelled at by Yankees PR for trying to talk to him, and Judge was like, sorry. Like, he was very nice about it.
All right, Jason, what do you think?
I think the Houston Astros fans are sick of the Red Sox and the Yankees. They were so annoyed that they had to play all their games. What were they playing their games at 8 in the morning for the Red Sox and the Yankees to play in prime time? The Astros are just fed up with all this East Coast media bias.
So speaking of East Coast media bias, we should acknowledge the media bias of this panel, which is we are three Red Sox fans, right?
I mean, Jason doesn't care about anything.
I'm sated, Karen. I'm sated. Like, three titles in 15 years will do that to you.
You were wearing a Red Sox jersey, so I'm just pointing it out.
It was a Babe Ruth jersey, however.
I'm not even going to pretend, Karen. I'm a homer.
Right. But Jason, what you just said about being sated is exactly my thoughts. I keep hearing people say, and this is crazy to me, like, oh, the Red Sox are playing a lot better than they have recently. Yeah. Like, they're due. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Yeah. Like, we don't actually need another championship.
Winners are never satisfied, Karen.
Put
your head in the game.
5 years ago.
You realize, Karen, that there are six-year-olds in New England who have only been to one Duck Boat Red Sox parade.
It's horrifying.
And they have waited long enough.
Think of the children. All right, so I want to move us out of New England and talk about Jimmy Butler. He had an exciting return to Minnesota Timberwolves practice on Wednesday. Butler's looking for a trade, and to facilitate a trade, he reportedly played brilliantly during practice while screaming things like, "You bleeping need me," and other things I can't say on the radio. And then he sat down with ESPN's Rachel Nichols.
Was it the right way to do it? No, but I can't control that when I'm out there competing. Like, that's my love of the game. That's raw me. Me at my finest. Me at my purest. That's what you're going to get inside the lines.
And I was going to say, is it not the right way for it to come out? Do you think it was the wrong thing to do, or was it an okay thing to do?
I think that I was honest.
Okay, let's try that again. Yes. Yes, it was the wrong thing to do. Look, I know it's ridiculous to expect athletes to be role models. They're not elementary school teachers, after all. They're athletes. But as frustrating as your situation might be, if you are an athlete, kids are going to do what you do. So it's not okay. Maybe understandable, but not okay. Charlotte, I know you sometimes enjoy it when the NBA ventures into WWE territory, so I'm going to let you go first.
You know me too well, Karen. This is a little concerning. I'm worried about my reputation. Look, I think that what athletes are very good at these days is owning a news cycle. Jimmy Butler knew exactly what he was doing, and the report about his practice came out, and 2 hours later, he was on The Jump with Rachel. I don't really care. Like, I don't know if I would say it's okay or not. I think that kids are going to act like idiots no matter what, so I don't think that one athlete trying to get more airtime is necessarily going to be, like, a role model issue. I do think that if I were his teammates, I'd be like, what are you doing, man? But I think that it's all pretty calculated.
Charlotte, so cynical. You think the fact that ESPN was on Timberwolves campus for this meltdown with advance warning was somehow a bit of choreography on Team Butler's part?
Jason, I don't want to say I said that, but I didn't not say that.
Karen, also, I have seen you walk into the studio saying, "You bleepin' need me." So, I don't know if you're one to cast stones. You know, this is where the NBA is now. It's almost become less in common with a traditional sports league and more like the Marvel comic universe, where these players are kind of superhero-like and they have enemies both on their own squads and on squads elsewhere.
I'm just going to leave it at, you know, Charlotte made the point that the media is being used here. And as a member of the media, I'm just going to say, I don't like being used.
Really? I'm, like, totally okay with it.
Yeah, yeah.
Give me those clicks.
Yeah, yeah, just use me up. Fine, I don't care.
Bill Withers.
All right, gang. You probably know that once more, the Alabama Crimson Tide are the number one college football team in the country. And you surely know that Alabama head coach Nick Saban's hair is once again silky and lustrous.
It's really nice.
But all is not well in Tuscaloosa because those bratty, good-for-nothing Alabama students are getting increasingly ambivalent about attending one-sided football games.
No.
Once more, Nick Saban is on the warpath against his own student body. We're talking friendly fire for their paltry attendance at Crimson Tide football games. His poor Crimson Tide players look up in the stands in the middle of games, and it looks like a Miami Marlins game up there. Look, here is a thought for Alabama. Play some exciting football games that begin at reasonable times. Nick Saban actually got himself worked up about the student crowd at a football game that began at 11 a.m., Charlotte. 11 a.m. on a Saturday. Does he realize that it's illegal for a college student to wake up before noon on a weekend? Also, Alabama was playing Louisiana Lafayette. I mean, no disrespect to Louisiana Lafayette, but do you know what the score was at halftime?
What was the score?
It was 795,000 to nothing. Okay. No, it was 49 to nothing. It was 49 to nothing at the half.
Part of me, this is a little weird of a take, I realize. Part of me kind of sees where he's coming from.
Okay, I want to hear it.
I do, because, like, here's this team that you've devoted your life to making this insane powerhouse, and you are the best college football team that has maybe ever existed.
Yeah.
And then people stop going to your games, I'd be like, what did I, like, are you kidding me? I did this for you. I mean, I also did this for the millions of dollars I paid and the prestige and the chance to, you know, do whatever I want after this. But I do kind of understand.
But Charlotte, you are a fancy pants traveling Sports Illustrated correspondent now. You have been to these major college events. You know that big time college sports in 2018, the last thing it has anything to do with are students. It's about boosters and television and primetime and sponsors.
Okay, here's a thought. Maybe they should pay the students to go to the games.
Now you're talking, Charlotte Wilder. That is perfect. Exactly.
Amateurism needs to die.
What would get you out of bed before noon? What's a figure? I would need a number here.
Oh, it doesn't take much for a college student, really.
Yeah, in college, if you paid me $20 to go to a football game,
$20.
Like, totally.
Now, I believe this is an NCAA violation, I support
but less
it.
Of a violation than paying the players.
Right. You could also give me just like a pair of sneakers and an Escalade.
Ooh, okay.
And then I'd definitely go.
I mean, to me, this whole thing reeks of like kids get off my lawn, right? Like, because,
old man yelling at clouds.
Right. Like, student attendance numbers are down across the board in college football.
Yep.
Schools are having to do more to attract fans. They're offering free Wi-Fi. They're selling beer. You know what? Maybe students just have better things to do with their time. I know that Nick Saban and a certain segment of the population is going to feel awful about this, right? Like, this was a thing that was really important to them at this point in their lives. And now it's not as important. But you know what? That's like the progress of human history.
No, Karen, I think the kids are getting soft.
You know what I think, Karen?
Yeah.
I think you bleepin' need me.
My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Sports Illustrated's Charlotte Wilder and The Wall Street Journal's Jason Gay. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you, Karen. Always super fun.
Thanks, Karen. You know I didn't want to be here.
Rich Ellinson runs a website, BaltimoreColtsMania.com. He built it in the mid-1990s, in the early days of the internet, and it shows. Big banner across the top, a menu bar running down the left side, and a bunch of text in the middle. The only colors are black, white, and royal blue.
Its design is stuck in the past gloriously, just as the Colts really are stuck in the past.
Just a couple of weeks ago, Rich updated the site. It was the first time he had touched it in 10 months.
It was tough. It was really, really tough just to type those words. And, you know, it's just one line of text on a Baltimore Colts website that I don't even know how many people would even read. But, you know, for me, it had the weight of the world behind it.
The story of BaltimoreColtsMania.com doesn't start in the mid-90s when Rich opened up an HTML textbook and taught himself some simple coding. It started long before that, in a front yard in northern New Jersey, just outside of New York City, where Rich and his dad would play catch every Sunday.
And it wasn't very large, but we played catch all the time there. And my dad would throw the football to me and he would say, "I'm Johnny Unitas."
Johnny Unitas was, of course, the legendary quarterback of the Baltimore Colts. He was with the team from 1956 to 1972, was a three-time NFL MVP, and won three NFL championships and a Super Bowl. All of this happened long before Rich Ellinson was born. So in that front yard in northern New Jersey, Rich's dad, Bernie, would draw pass routes for his young son to follow. Usually those run by Unitas's favorite receiver, Raymond Berry.
You're going to take three steps up and take a sharp right, and I'm going to hit you right in the hands. I'm going to hit you right in the hands.
Unitas back to throw, does throw. It's good to Berry.
Just like Unitas to Berry. Unitas to Berry over and over again.
Now he throws. It's good to Berry. He's at the 45.
He grew up in Baltimore during the peak of the team. He had fond memories of his childhood. And I felt like for him, he was really trying to reach back to a time so the team wasn't forgotten.
It wasn't just that Johnny U was long retired that made this Sunday ritual odd. It wasn't that they were in northern New Jersey, nowhere near Baltimore. It was odd because the Baltimore Colts hadn't existed since March 29th, 1984.
By 10 o'clock this morning, most of the equipment and Colt memorabilia had been moved out of the Colt complex in Owings Mills.
The team left in the middle of the night when I was only 4 years old. And I wish I could tell you a story of my dad crying, but I don't recall that, of course.
By midday, everyone had left the Colt complex. All that remained was one pickup truck owned by the team.
He never really talked about it much other than they were stolen in the middle of the night and they were just gone just like that.
It's interesting because some people would say they left us in the middle of the night and he saw it as they were stolen.
Yeah. He felt like they were the city of Baltimore was robbed. The Colts were successful. They were very successful, which was great for the city because the city, he always told me, felt it had an inferiority complex with the rest of the I-95 corridor. And for the team to have any success, especially against the New York Giants from New York City, that brought unbelievable pride and made them not feel as just a city that you would drive through between D.C. and New York.
Whenever Rich and his dad would watch football on TV and the announcers would point out an amazing play, Bernie would tell Rich about a time 20, 30 years earlier when a Colts player had done the same thing.
So then I would meet up with my friends who would talk about current players like Joe Montana or Troy Aikman or Brett Favre. And I'd say, well, yeah, you know, Unitas did that. And they would just roll their eyes because I was out to lunch, it seemed like, talking about a team that doesn't exist anymore.
Still, the lesson stuck. So when Rich was in high school, he decided he wanted to teach the world about the greatness of the Baltimore Colts. He built a website, writing up stories told by his father, adding a bit of his own research and links to any news about the team. What did you know about starting a website or building one?
I knew nothing. I had a goal to make the site, to make my dad happy. And so I was going to stop at nothing to learn what I need to learn to make it happen.
Rich says his family was going through some tough financial times back then. His dad felt responsible.
He had a career in marketing, in corporate marketing life in New York City, Bristol Myers and Clairol and Revlon. And when he got let go from those jobs, he was down. I just thought this was a way to reach out. Show him that I listened and I heard all of his stories. And quite frankly, to show him that I loved him, because I did and I still do.
Rich says his dad wasn't very tech savvy. He didn't really see why he would go on the internet to look up things he already knew. But when Rich showed Bernie what he had done,
he was floored. He didn't even know what to say. He said, "How did you learn to do this? When did you do this? How did you know all this stuff?" I just kind of shrugged my shoulders. I said, "I learned it. I taught myself."
Throughout Rich's teenage and young adult years, the website was always something he and his dad could talk about. It was safe. There was never a reason to disagree about the Baltimore Colts.
A point of conversation was always, how's the website doing? How's that Colts website doing? Did you hear from anybody interesting?
Over the years, Rich heard from lots of interesting people, other Colts fans who had their own stories to tell. Eventually, BaltimoreColtsMania.com even got some media attention. In 2007, when the Indianapolis Colts came to town to play the Ravens, the Baltimore Sun interviewed Rich Ellinson, son of Bernie.
He was over the moon excited. Even for him, I don't think his hyperbole matched his actual excitement, if that's even possible. You know, for me to be interviewed by his hometown paper, the Baltimore Sun, he couldn't stop but tell every single person. He said, "Oh, and do you know Richie's being interviewed in the Baltimore Sun?"
Rich got married, moved to California. He'd update the website when he could, usually late at night. When the first of his two sons were born, Rich and Bernie posed with all three generations and Rich's copy of Tom Callahan's biography titled Johnny U.
You know, we kind of did it in a joking way, and my wife rolled her eyes, kind of wondering, what are you doing? But we were kind of serious. You know, this is our thing. The Johnny U and the Colts were our thing, and we're going to keep it going as long as we can.
Over time, Rich found fewer and fewer articles to link to on the site, mostly just obituaries of players who had passed away. Fans were dying, too. Not many people were visiting the site anymore.
In the last year, I've received maybe 5 or 6 emails from Colts fans. During its heyday, if you will, I was getting 2 or 3 emails a week. But once Unitas passed away in 2012, I think the interest went away.
And then came that update, the one Rich posted just a few weeks ago, the one he was dreading.
Whenever I updated the website, it was about Baltimore Colts news and things that I thought visitors to the site wanted to know or should know. So unfortunately, in December of last year, my father died. And certainly the website was not the first thing I thought of when he passed away, but it was up there thinking, oh, I'm going to have to update the website.
What did it say?
I think it just said, sad news, my father, my rock and my foundation, and the foundation for this website passed away in December of 2017. For me, that made his death real. If it's on the website, that makes it real and truthful. I haven't looked at the site again since then. I don't know that I need to or I want to.
So is that it for the website? Do you think you'll ever update it again?
I don't see updating it again. I don't know how much longer it'll go. It might maybe just go until the registration runs out in about 10 months or so. Shutting down the website would be really hard. I know it's probably the right thing to do, maybe. As I, you know, in this first year of grief, it's really hard. And I find myself reaching all over the place to grab things that remind me of him. And the one thing I don't want is my father's memory to be forgotten.
As Rich Ellenson reaches for his father, he remembers more than just stories about Johnny Unitas and the Baltimore Colts. He remembers a man who was never afraid to show his emotions. He remembers long hugs at life's milestones, graduation, the birth of his two sons. And he remembers the tears that would stream down his father's face.
I hope to pass it on to my two sons, that it's okay to cry. It's okay to be emotional, and it's okay to stand up for Johnny Unitas. It's okay to stand up for him. He was a great quarterback, and don't forget him, and don't forget my dad.
After updating his website with the news of his father's passing, Rich Ellenson sent an email to oag@wbur.org. That's how we first learned of his story. Do you have a story you'd like to hear on Only a Game? Send us an email. That address again is oag@wbur.org. We'll be right back with Charlie Pierce. Don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
NPR's Code Switch tackles race and identity in America with humanity and humor. You'll laugh, you'll learn, you'll get uncomfortable. It's worth it. Find Code Switch on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Karen Given. Next week on Only a Game, Nike released the Air Swoops more than 20 years ago. But nowadays, most WNBA stars wear men's signature shoes. What gives? But now it's time for the week's news with Charlie Pierce. Hi, Charlie.
All you women, all you want to talk about is shoes.
Well, speaking of shoes, Philadelphia 76ers center Joel Embiid has signed a 5-year deal with Under Armour. It'll make him the highest compensated player at his position. And he told ESPN, quote, "There's a stereotype about big men that we can't sell shoes. Is that because shoes look really weird in a size 17?
Yes. I mean, speaking as someone who bought at a charity auction an autographed Shaquille O'Neal shoe my son, which I believe we're using as a carport now. The problem with that, they look fine on the big men.
Right.
But when you put them on a shelf, they look like art objects. But if anybody can do it, it's Joel Embiid, who has charisma beyond belief. So, I mean, he's going to make a lot of money at this. And as he says, he's not really a center anyway. He thinks of himself as a guard. I mean, he might as well think of himself as a Martian, for all I'm concerned. But, you know, this is the way of the world these days.
Yeah, I mean, he said, I'm not really a big man. And, of course, he's certainly big. He's 7 feet tall.
Yeah.
But he says he can do it all, which I guess means he can shoot and
which
not
means,
just
which
block.
Means the coaching staff of the Philadelphia 76ers have just had a stroke, all three of them.
The college basketball corruption trial has been underway for a while now, Charlie, but the big allegations are starting to drop. Anything here that shocks you?
Yes. What's shocked me all along, which is the FBI spending my money to become the enforcement arm of the NCAA. There is nothing you can do. There isn't a bribe big enough to make me care about this bribery trial. It's recriminalizing an underground economy. The whole thing is just silly. The players are the ones who are going to get hurt most. And the NCAA, which was on the ropes and staggering, has now found its way back to what it perceives to be the moral high ground. And I couldn't be more disgusted.
Speaking of the players are the ones that get hurt, the New York Times brought up an interesting question this week. And that's who's the real victim here. The prosecutors say the victim is the universities. Fans might say it's us, but the New York Times suggests that it's Brian Tuggs Bowen, whose father agreed to take money from Adidas, and as a result, Tuggs is now playing in Australia.
Well, there's nothing wrong with playing in Australia. Australia is a really nice place, but it's also not national television. You know, I think Brian Bowen's going to be fine. I think he's going to do his apprenticeship in Australia and come back and get drafted pretty high. But again, the fact remains is this whole notion that somehow the universities have been victimized by these guys taking money from shoe company guys, as though the universities haven't been accepting that as business as usual for 30 years, is one of the ways they've turned the bribery laws in this thing into a pretzel.
Charlie, last week on this show, we learned that the woman who is accusing Juventus star Cristiano Ronaldo of rape had compelling evidence in the form of a legal document in which Ronaldo admitted to non-consensual sex. Now Ronaldo's lawyer is saying that document was acquired in a computer hack and altered. So now what?
Well, this is one of the 8,000 reasons why I didn't go to law school. I think certainly burden of proof is on Ronaldo and his lawyers to prove the thing was hacked. That sounds like a very expeditious discovery all of a sudden. Otherwise, let's let this thing get litigated, but I don't envy the judge at all.
Right.
Because there's clearly a lot of money on the side of Mr. Ronaldo, who's capable of buying a lot of forensics.
You've written a lot in your other jobs about the nature of truth and how hard it is to figure out what is true. And when people start calling into question legal documents, I really get confused.
Yeah,
like, what can we trust?
Well, I mean, you know, given the nature of how much we rely on computers these days, there's always going to be somebody who knows more about it than you do. So, I mean, a lot of institutions have been undermined or, quote unquote, disrupted, which is apparently the term of art for it. I mean, I guess you just have to trust your instinct and understand that the legal process will grind on.
European soccer has long had a problem with racist fans, and Chelsea has decided that just banning offenders from the stadium isn't changing things. Instead, they're going to give offenders the opportunity to, quote, spend some time with our diversity officers, understanding what you did wrong. And this time isn't going to be spent in a classroom, right?
No, they're going to take them to Auschwitz, which I will guarantee you most of these people will not connect with the black people they're insulting. It's a good idea. You know, maybe they should all get on an airplane and go to the new anti-lynching memorial down in Alabama that Brian Stevenson's place put up. I like inventive thinking on this sort of thing. Go on a road trip and go see what the end result of what you're doing is.
And finally, Charlie, I'm just going to let you explain what was mysterious about the guy wearing number 13 when Hawaii faced Wyoming last Saturday night.
He was an imposter. Their quarterback. They beat Wyoming, by the way, in this game, 17-13. But their starting quarterback, Cole McDonald, he had some sort of injury that they did not want to disclose. Somebody came out onto the field, warmed up wearing his jersey.
And nobody knows who it is.
This is something like, the, you know, throwing the potato to throw the guy out at third base. You know, this is a real throwback to the Wild West days of sports, and I love it. I think it's probably something you can only use once, though.
Right. You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at Sports Illustrated, and he joins us each week on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Karen.
On December 9th, 1978, the Chicago Hustle and Milwaukee Does faced off in the debut of the new Women's Basketball League, or WBL. The league featured future Hall of Famers Nancy Lieberman and Ann Muffet McGraw, but it really struggled to bring in money. For one team in particular, finding a way to survive was especially difficult. Here's reporter Tal Pinchevsky.
In 1979, the Women's Basketball League appeared to be shifting into high gear. Even though the Dayton Rockettes folded amid financial hardship, the league added a third division with six new teams from Philadelphia to San Francisco. Among the league's boldest moves was establishing the Dreams, a Southern California-based club that would split games between Long Beach and Orange County.
We had a great training facility. We had, you know, two arenas that we were playing out of, and we played a couple of games premier to the Lakers games.
That's Michelle McKenzie, one of four former Dayton players who came to Southern California after the Rockettes folded.
And a lot of us had experience in the game, and we kind of knew of each other. And so that's what kind of made me feel like, wow, we're going to have a championship team here.
But when Vonnie Rakitic, known then as Vonnie Tomic, arrived in California, she had concerns about the accommodations given to the team president.
You know, in this big office with the leather chairs and the whole thing.
Vonnie starred at Illinois State University and was a WBL All-Star in Dayton before joining the Dreams.
At that point, we were just beginning, and I don't feel like the way they appropriated money was, you know, to the best interests of our team. Because you're not looking to look like a big shot. You're trying to get something off the ground. Leagues don't start, you know, on Michigan Avenue.
During the league's first season, the WBL's westernmost team was the Houston Angels. Now there would be two teams in California embarking on lengthy road trips that crisscrossed the nation.
I thought it was kind of crazy to go to California. It should have stayed in the Midwest and the East. You know, I thought it expanded way too fast. The second year is ridiculous to expand, in my opinion.
The California Dreams faced geographic and financial hurdles even before playing their first game. So as the 1979-80 season got underway, the Dreams president approached head coach Mel Sims with a plan to make the team's players stand out in Southern California's cluttered sports market.
They were going to send them to charm school because they wanted to change the image of the game.
Yes, charm school. More specifically, John Robert Powers Charm School in Los Angeles. The academy had locations nationwide and was founded by a former actor who began teaching etiquette in the 1920s. Alumni of the school included Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis, Betty Ford, and Princess Grace of Monaco.
We just assumed that this was, you know, something that had to be done if you wanted to play ball for California, that this was a part of being a professional athlete. It didn't cross our minds to say, well, I wonder if men do this. We just wanted to be compliant and go along with the program.
They were taught how to dress, how to walk more feminine, how to speak with the opposite sex, all those kind of things.
There's a way that a young lady gets in and out of a car. You back into a car and you swing your legs in. And as you get out of the car, you swing both legs out at the same time outside the car, and then you proceed to walk. It stuck. I still do that.
But the expectation that athletes must also be charming caused some ripples.
And they gave us a little bit of makeup, but, you know, the ladies' arguments were, well, wait a minute, we're not going to be wearing makeup when we're on the court, okay? I'm not going to spend a whole bunch of money on makeup, and then I'm going to go on the court and sweat it off. And so, of course, it became a little bit of a joke after a couple of the sessions.
We eat at, for instance, at Denny's, and Denny's gives you a knife and a fork. They would place their glass. Oh, remember, your glass goes here. Okay, the fork goes here. But where's my salad fork? Where's this fork? It would be comical.
One, that is absolutely a ridiculous way to spend money.
That's Vonnie Rakitic again. And as you can probably tell by the tone of her voice, she wasn't exactly thrilled about the whole charm school idea.
Two, I remember going to, like, the hairdresser and them telling us how to wear our hair, you know, what would be best for us. This is all on that outer show. I think, you know, we're female athletes, and I think they're trying to portray us as something else. I really didn't take it too seriously because I thought it was ridiculous. I was there for a reason. I stayed focused on the sport, and I just thought it was silly.
And the California Dreams had more glaring issues than how their players got in and out of cars, issues that were apparent to Coach Sims the moment he joined the club.
They did things backwards. They selected the team first and selected the coach second. Well, when I got there and I saw the players for the first time, I asked, where are all the guards? And they didn't select guards. I nicknamed them the California Nightmares because we couldn't get the ball across half court most of the time simply because we didn't have the guard know-how.
The Dream started the season 1-7. While teams in Chicago and Iowa drew thousands of spectators to every home game, the Dreams played to mostly empty seats.
It was terrible. And sometimes they had more ticket takers than we had spectators. And we gave away more tickets than we could sell. And that was very discouraging to go into an arena and play before, you know, 80, 90 people. And that was a good crowd. And probably half those tickets were given. And so people weren't buying into the idea of the women's basketball.
My biggest memory is probably my husband wearing a T-shirt that said, "My wife is a dream."
That's Anne Muffet McGraw. She's currently the women's basketball coach at the University of Notre Dame. Partway through the 1979-80 season, after the Dreams had completed their charm school courses, she joined the team with the hopes of filling the glaring void at the guard position.
We weren't making a lot of money. I remember my salary was $11,000, and we used to, I'd have my husband waiting outside in the car with the engine running. I'd run out, jump in the car, we'd head off to the bank, because sometimes all the checks didn't cash. So first one to the bank wins.
Money became a big issue. We were traveling and we didn't know how we were going to get home. We ran out of money. We had to change hotels once because we didn't have money.
With games still left on the 1979-80 WBL schedule, Mel Sims was fired. Before their inaugural season was complete, the Dreams were over. The WBL followed a year later. And although the experiment was short-lived, the Dreams' attendance at Charm School highlighted some of the issues women in sports continue to face today. Here's Vonnie Rakitic.
It hasn't stopped, if you want to know. That's why girls have issues at college. That's why they have to worry about sexual assault. Because of that mentality has never left.
Still, despite its shortcomings, the league did offer players and coaches a historic opportunity in the years immediately following Title IX. Again, Anne McGraw.
We played in an era where we waited for the guys to finish practice. They flew to games. We took the bus. It was completely different. And I think that we feel like we maybe at least laid some groundwork for women today, for what they have now. We look at the WNBA and think, maybe because we were there, and even though we failed as a league after a couple of years, at least we got it started.
That story came from reporter Tal Pinchevsky. This past summer, the WBL was enshrined into the Women's Basketball Hall of Fame and awarded the hall's Trailblazer Award. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach, with help from Matthew Stock. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our senior producer is me. I'm Karen Given. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.